The following is presented to you in Around Sound.
It was recorded with whatever was lying around.
Lady don't take no shit, insist on respect the sister, walk around like a womanish. Yeah. She won't speak less of something worse, singing don't play. The girl take herself so serious, like, people stare curious, like, she got a natural way, her hips sway furious, like, yet luxurious, like, carries herself like the cutest, most prettiest thing you see this side of the bay.
Hey, this is Lady Don't Take No, your weekly roundup of all of the real and none of the fake. I'm your host, Alicia Garza. This show is pro-black, pro-queer, proudly feminist, and pro-do what you like. Every week, you're going to get the best of what goes on in my head, what we loving on, and what we hating on, what we might be, and what we ain't going to do. Politics, pop culture, prison sentences pending or announced, we cover it all. We know that no matter where you are, it's a challenging time, a changing time, a time of transformation. It's all the things all the time nowadays, but we are going to help you understand the dynamics of this time every single week. So be sure to tune in, tell a friend, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We do it for the culture, so the pod is free 99, because we know that with a country in chaos, the least we could do is keep you from putting your money anywhere else than where it's needed.
She got her razor sharp quick, and she just won't quit. Uh-huh. Flaunting it, body built like a house made out of brick. She got the smart style and finesse, compounded with a blessed profound intellect.
Our guest this week is an award-winning journalist, child advocate, and college professor. She is the author of That Mean Old Yesterday, Spare the Kids, Why Whooping Children Won't Save Black America, and the forthcoming Strung Up, The Lynching of Black Children in Jim Crow America. She is also the creator of SpareTheKids.com, an online portal designed to teach about the harms of hitting children. You can often find her commenting on race, education, and child welfare issues on CNN, ABC, Democracy Now!, and countless other outlets. Please, please welcome my friend, my muse, Dr. Stacey Patton. Hey, Stacey Pants, what's cracking? What's popping? What are we doing?
Hey, girl. Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. It has been a long time coming. I've been literally like holding my sides as I'm scrolling through Facebook on my little breaks and just watching you eviscerate the lesser rappers that attempt to get in the ring. And if you don't follow Stacey on Facebook or any of the socials, if she'll let you, definitely do it because you will not be disappointed. Stacey, I want to jump into all the questions because you know I have them. But first and foremost, listen, not only are we in a pandemic, a global pandemic with this like COVID-19, Rona and all her fucking cousins. But not only that, but now, right, her in-laws don't come to stay. Now we got fucking monkeypox. And I'm just not understanding why I'm getting on planes and people be barefoot and shit on top of like not wearing fucking masks. And I know we're not supposed to shame people for not wearing masks, but fuck that. Put on a fucking mask, especially when you're in an airplane with like hell of other people that you don't fucking know. Hello. So contrary to popular opinion, we are still in a pandemic and she done brought her in-laws, yo. So I got to ask you, what has your quarantine life been like? And have you developed any unique habits live and direct from Miss Rona?
Well, I have to say, I had a bad case of COVID. Ooh. Late December into January. It took me about 2 months to recover.
Oh my God, I was so sorry.
Fully vaccinated, got it from a vaccinated person.
Oh, shit.
And it's no joke. It's nothing to play around with. And, you know, I had to transition back to teaching in the classroom with an N95 on while still trying to get my full wind back. And so I was very careful even prior to this. Of all places, I got it at the hair salon.
I can't. Actually, yes, I can. I'd be asking now. I'd be like, now, nigga, is you vaccinated? And don't fucking lie, because you all up in my shit right now. All up in my crown, you know.
So, yeah, I bought it back on a lock that got me sick. So I was very careful. Quarantine, didn't really go out many places, you know, grocery store, Home Depot.
Mm-hmm. You stay at Home Depot.
And so I have still been very careful since then. I still wear a mask. People look at me like I'm crazy. I don't care because I don't want to get it again.
Listen.
You know, and I mean, I just think what we're witnessing is kind of COVID fatigue, where people are just like, screw it. You know, I'm just going to be out here and be free, but they really don't understand germ theory, how pandemics work, that this is not something that just lasts a few months. It can go on for years and mutate and get stronger. So I've been, you know, going out when necessary. When I do go out, always wear a mask. You know, fist bumps, mm-hmm. You know, I'll hug you if I really know you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I spend a lot of time outdoors. I'm on an acre of land. Mm. Got a new house, so my hands are in the soil. I'm building things. I'm sweating all the toxins out while getting my vitamin D on. So that's been my quarantine life and writing and, you know, doing what I do.
Oh, I love this. I love this. And also, I am in awe of your home improvement projects, and I'm working up the nerve. You know what I'm saying? I'm a fan of throwing money at the problem, but these contractors can fucking eat it.
Oh, man.
They can eat it.
That's a whole podcast, but that's a whole separate episode on dealing with the triflingness of contractors. I have learned so much about the male species, you know, dealing with contractors. Like, my middle name is now Freudisha, because I go and I look up these behaviors and I'm like, there's a term for that in a DSM-4.
So I
want to be like, here's a bottle of water. Let's talk about your relationship
with
your mama.
Let's talk about this, right? No, it's a lot. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, that's another podcast. We're going to talk about this, just you and me, and then we'll figure out what's safe for consumption for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. We're in a moment, Stacey, in this country, and it's not just one moment. I mean, let's be honest. This country is so raggedy, is the only word that I could use to describe it. And we've had this whole narrative over the last 4 years in particular about the polarization of the country. I'm like, no, we've been polarized, right? We've been polarized.
From its inception.
But we just keep getting better at telling stories that are full of amnesia. That's why y'all feel like all of a sudden we're separate. We've been separate for a long time. But I'm struck by not the polarization that people are talking about, but the real deep internalization of stories about this nation and about each other and who we can or can't be together that are so incredibly virulent. And every day people are getting indoctrinated to new stories. And so, you know, what would happen if as a nation we were more inclined to be wrong sometimes? And so I want to ask you if you can tell me a story about a time that you changed your mind and what happened. And I mean, I want you to think about something where you were like really, really convinced, like this is the way this motherfucking shit is, but then your perspective changed.
This is long silence because I generally don't operate with a closed heart and mind. I've always been someone who sits on the edge of her seat, waiting to be shaken up and waiting for somebody to tell me something I don't know, waiting for somebody to turn my insides upside down and shift my thinking on everything. So I guess I would describe myself as someone who has evolved her thinking on things. You know, I obsess over children. And for the longest time, as a scholar, as a journalist, as a child activist, I had this one particular kind of framework that guided my scholarship, my understanding of childhood and why we treat children the way we treat them, particularly Black children. And so for the longest time, I was on this, oh, Black children are being denied innocence, that Black children are being adultified. And so that explains why they're being killed by cops, that people seem to, white people seem to be having these reverse hallucinations mm-hmm. when they see a 10-year-old and in their mind it's a 20-year-old mm-hmm. or the sexualization of Black girls. I was so convinced that this is that adultification was the guiding principle. And I met this political scientist from Canada who totally, I mean, we argued hard about this, but he convinced me that I was not understanding what adultification and infantilization mixed in with racism really was about. And he's like, you know, Black children are not being killed because they're being adultified, that people don't recognize them as children. They're being treated the way they are precisely because they're children and they're Black. Mm. Because Black people as a race has always existed in a continuous limbo of childhood, that we're a child race. We never grow up. We never mature. We never age out of brutality. And he helped me understand that Black people had inherited the European ideal of childhood, which was always a state of abuse and sexualization and barbarism and denial of the privileges of adulthood. And it totally blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, I have this all backwards. I wrote a whole dissertation on it. Ooh. Get my PhD.
Listen.
Like, who wants to write a dissertation and be like, oh my God, it was all wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's all wrong. Mm-hmm. And I had to change my language as an activist, change, you know, my workshops, how I talk with parents and clinicians and educators about how we treat children. And I mean, I sat there for a moment like, dang. Mind totally blown. And I was like, okay, it doesn't make me any less of a scholar because I, you know, got some new information that had me reconceptualize everything. And it made me better for it. So I've had a moment like that as a scholar. I mean, I've had smaller moments as a human being, you know, as a woman, as a friend, you know, all of those sorts of things. So it's open heart, open mind. You never know where the light might come from.
You know, when I was prepping to talk with you today, Stacey, I started thinking about Ida B. Wells. And I'm always really curious to know what inspires somebody to embark on a crusade, right? Like there's things that I feel passionate about, but it's not like a crusade for me. It's not like the thing I get out of bed and I'm thinking about how do I get people to really understand this? That's actually, my crusade is about Black political power, right? So I could like deeply understand and identify with that. Now, Ida B. Wells became a journalist because she was fucking pissed. I mean, she was like enraged, right? And she was enraged about how she was treated as a woman and how women were treated. She was also enraged because she was born into slavery and she experienced emancipation in air quotes in her lifetime. And she was enraged about the treatment of Black people. And then she was enraged about the treatment of Black women. And so she like literally was just like on a mission every day to highlight and expose the ways in which we were being dehumanized. You're well known for your crusade to end the practice of violence against children. Tell me a little bit about what started you on this journey.
Well, first, let me say that Ida B. Wells is my hero, my muse. I have a whole shelf I'm looking at with all her stuff. She also wrote about the lynching of Black children as well. And I just love her story. I mean, she was a little woman. Tiny little something, just fierce.
That's
my
right.
favorite story
That's
of hers. Right. You know, they tried to throw her off of a train. I think it was in Memphis. And she bit the conductor's hand.
Like
that was just gangster stuff.
That's what
and
I'm talking
she
about.
Then she said, I'm going to sue you. Right?
So yes, she I won. Just, wait, she won though. Because wait, check this out. So she hired a Black lawyer and they paid off the motherfucking lawyer. And so she hired a white lawyer and she won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, she's just my, like, and when you see her clapbacks, you know, against mm-hmm. white feminists and others. You know, that's a whole nother story, but definitely, you know, she inspires my activism, my journalism. I have a whole textbook campaign for HBCU students that I do every semester. It's called the Ida B. Wells Textbook Fund. So, you know, she is my goddess. So my Orisha. Mm. And in terms of my own work, I guess you could say I decided to do this work focusing on eliminating corporal punishment against children because I'm pissed. I just think it's so ridiculous that people hit children. It's just the most obtuse thing in the world to me that you throw hands at a child because you can't control yourself. And I've increasingly become so exasperated by all the excuses that people use to justify hitting children. Religion, you know, I turned out fine. You're hitting a child. You didn't turn out fine. I want to keep them out of jail, keep the cops from killing them. Well, how's that working for Black America? You know, I'm successful because I'm, you know, somebody hit me. Like, wow, you agree with masses logic that in order to make you, you know, a fine, upstanding, successful, law-abiding citizen, your body needed to be processed through violence. So there's just this whole well of talking points about why we need to hit children. You know, I wake up every single morning of my life. And when I look in the mirror, I see these extension cord marks on my face, put there by an adoptive mother who used those same talking points, who was treated that way, whose parents were treated that way, whose grand, this comes right out of slavery. And, you know, I never felt love when I was being hit. I never felt protected. I felt like this is so unnecessary. Just talk to me. Just show me what you need me to do. And I was wholly unsuited to be dealt with in that way. So I ran away. First time I was like 8 years old, I was like, deuces, I'm out. They put me back, social services. Ran away again when I was 12, never went back. And I made a promise when I was a 12-year-old child that I was going to spend the balance of my life doing something. I didn't know what it was at 12 years old, but doing something to make sure that other little girls and boys didn't have to become adults and look at scars on their face because somebody beat them with a belt or an extension cord or slapped them in the face. And so I embarked on that journey. It really began when I was in graduate school and I was doing a PhD program in African-American history. And I wanted to do my dissertation tracing the trajectory of corporal punishment in African-American families and communities. But then I found this, all of this other mess that white people were, you know, expressing about Black children. I was like, wait a minute. I got to write about racialized pedophilic pornography. I got to write about little Black kids in Oklahoma being blown up by dynamite by white men because they inherited oil-rich lands. I got to write about how the pediatrics profession, you know, just basically characterized Black children's whole physiognomy as inferior. I had to do all of this other, you know, get through the ideological stuff, which deeply impacted the ways in which Black people internalize ideas about Black children's humanity and behavior and future prospects before I could even get into the corporal punishment stuff. So I got that out of the way. I wrote my first book about growing up in a foster care and dealing with that. But it was the Adrian Peterson case and the Baltimore mom situation that really sparked it up. I never thought I would write another book about corporal punishment. And so an editor approached me and she's like, I think you have a lot more to say about this. I was like, I've said everything I needed to say. But that was really a personal story. That Mean Old Yesterday was a personal story. So then I started really thinking about it and started listening to the discussions people were having around those two international stories. And I said, yep, I got a lot to say about this. And so the work continued and it continues to this day.
There's a lot to say in here, and actually, I have used some of those same adages. And I was spanked as a child, and I can only remember twice. But my mom used a switch. She used a switch. And I remember actually my dad sobbing and being like, please stop doing that. And they were like pissed at me. But I just remember this very stark image of my dad sobbing and my mom being like, shut up. She needs to understand right and wrong. And, you know, there are so many parents, I think, who are doing what they know and doing the best that they can. So this is no shade to my mother. This is something she learned. But I remember the practice of having to pick the weapon that I was being beaten with. And I always fucking pick the wrong one. You always think that the thin ones are going to hurt less, but it's actually not that way, right?
Worse. Yep.
So there is something very real, right, about the fear that Black parents have for their children and their livelihoods and their ability to stay alive. And at the same time, there is something very barbaric about using violence to help children understand how to avoid it. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, right? Like, what's wrong and what's right about these arguments of like accountability and discipline and learning right from wrong? And let's talk about it from your opinion and from your research. Like, what are you learning about what happens to Black children when they are beaten or when they are spanked? I mean, we don't even use, we use words that are even lighter, right, than the impact that it causes. So I'm curious if you can talk with us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I, you know, I'm not a parent. I always acknowledge that when I get in front of a room full of a few hundred people, I tell these folks, I am not here to tell you how to raise your child. I have never raised one. I don't know what that's like. And I'm not here to shame people, judge folks, but I'm here to give some information. And I walk them through this journey. I say, you know, this journey does not begin on American plantations. It does not begin in West Africa. It begins in Europe. Europeans were the first people to use this kind of ritualistic violence with their children. There is no historical record whatsoever of indigenous and African folks in the pre-colonial periods, that means pre-contact with white folks, using these kinds of strategies on our children. The language that we use to describe our children was different. Many West African cultures, you know, believe that children were gods. This is why I call children godlings all the time. They believe children were mystical. They were magical, that they were closer to the gods, that they were born and, you know, reborn ancestors. Hitting a child diminished you. The Nigerians would name their children things like Babatunde, father has returned, Yetatunde, mother has returned. The Bang people would never put a child on a floor because it was disrespectful. And we didn't have those kind of hierarchical, capitalistic, you know, social structures and economic structures that breed competition and coercion and hierarchy. We're communal people. And we didn't have these toxic religious idea that children were born in sin. They were born blessings. And so it is the history of colonization, indoctrination into a bastardized Western version of Christianity, the Middle Passage experience, hundreds of years of enslavement, Jim Crow terrorism, state-sanctioned violence, the rise of the carceral state in the late 19th century, the war on drugs, you know, the serial degradation of our lives at every turn that shaped parenting. So decolonization means that we have to understand how systems of oppression have shaped the way we see our children and how we treat them. The language that we use. I mean, so we talk a lot about racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and all these other ills. We talk about intersectionality, but everybody skips over the child. You say the word childism to people and they're like, what's that? I'm like, it's foundational to all of this other. So you don't get a racist unless you destroy a child first. So people don't understand that history and where this behavior actually came from. So I take them through that historical journey, the cultural stuff, you know, talk about these myths around hitting kids and our, you know, educational outcomes, zero tolerance policy, all the structural stuff that's bearing down on parents and families and stressing them out so that they don't have the emotional resources to be calm, to breathe, to be embodied, to feel their heartbeat, and to say, wait, I'm going into fight or flight mode and terror mode. So I'm about to hit my child. So when I'm in terror mode, I'm operating at a low IQ. So I don't have the creativity, the language, the sensors, all that stuff is shut down. So there's a whole neurological basis to why we hit kids. There's an epigenetic basis to it, right? So if you have these people who have been subjected to, from generation after generation, of all kinds of terror, it gets locked into our bodies. And we pass that on generation after generation to the point we're giving birth to children who are born anxious. And we're not given any sort of relief. It just becomes this perpetuating cycle. And then we laugh about it. We preach about it. We joke about it. We say this is a Black thing, and when it ain't even native to us. And so when I tell parents about going back to Europe, and I show them the ways in which Europeans have always been absolutely barbaric with children, you know, mass infanticide. They were the first people to lynch children. They lynched their own kids before they bought that behavior here and, you know, meted it out onto us. And so I traced that, the treatment, the religious ideas, all of that, and how we got transferred into our own culture to the point we think is normal and natural. It's so unnatural to our way of being. So then people are kind of open to that. They're like, wow, I never thought about that. But it's when I get to the neuroscience, when I start talking about the body, like what actually happens in a child's body when you hit them. I'm building a 3D medical animation app called When You Hit Me. And it basically shows parents that this fight or flight response actually happens before you even hit a child. A child can smell a whooping. Their eyes, their pupils dilate, the stomach, heart beats, lungs hyperventilate. You can go on top of the kidneys and see the adrenal glands, and that cortisol is bursting through the body. And so a lot of people will say to me, well, Stacy, there's a difference between spanking a child and abusing a child. And I say, that's absolutely false. That's not how the brain works. A child's developing brain does not know the difference between physical abuse that leaves visible scars, a broken bone, sexual abuse, which often leaves no traces long after the event, or a spanking that does not leave any visible signs. All three are toxic stress events. All three trigger the exact same neurochemical responses in the body that can literally change the physical architecture of a child's brain, can cause inflammation in the body, can set the stage for all kinds of chronic health issues that might not show up till after puberty, early adulthood, or when you have a net heart attack, or in these other chronic health issues that we're seeing in our communities. It's a load that we carry in our body. It can affect our birth outcomes, you know? And so it's when I start to get in the body and help Black people especially who've long been disembodied. We'd have to be disembodied to stay alive in this country, right? We have to connect with our own bodies, connect and empathize with our own children to really understand what we're doing with them. So it's cultural, it's historical, it's all these other myths, it's ideology, but it's also neuroscience as well.
I don't want to go without giving you a chance to talk a little bit about your new book, Lynching Children? What the fuck?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, when you hear about the lynching of children, everybody thinks about Emmett Till because he is, you know, the poster child and the spark for the modern civil rights movement, inspired the activism of Rosa Parks and others. But he was not the only Black child who was lynched. My victims are teenagers, adolescents, toddlers, babies, and my youngest victims are 9 fetuses.
Oh my God.
And so I'm using the NAACP's definition of lynching. A lot of people think that lynching is just being hung from the tree, but the majority of lynching victims were not you know, hanged from trees. They could be shot. They could be, you know, tortured and such. And so I started gathering the names of all of these children on an Excel file and looking at the circumstances surrounding their deaths and gathering photographs of, you know, these victims. And it is a chamber of horrors. It is the most difficult thing I've ever had to write. And I always feel so paralyzed after. I cannot imagine being a mother, giving birth to a child. Like, I birthed you into this world. I nurtured you, wiped your nose, all of this stuff. And these people can come into my house and take you out into the woods and do horrible things to you, horrible things, and kill you. And there's nothing that I or my community can do about this. You know, two people in my family were lynched. One in my adoptive family, and my biological mother's father was hogtied, tortured, and thrown in a swamp in 1969. And so as a child growing up in the 80s and 90s, I would hear these stories. And you could still see the fear and the terror when they were, you know, the family would talk about, almost in whispers, because they really didn't want the children to hear, but I was nosy. And so I just didn't know what lynching was until I started getting into my history courses. And I lived with those generational echoes. Part of that generational echo was them beating us because they didn't want this to happen to us. Because after emancipation, Black parenting was could be a site of resistance. We could raise resistance or we could raise order. If you want to control the future, you attack their children. It's the easy way to do this. Because there was an urgent question this country had to deal with after emancipation. You know, what are we going to do with these 4 million Negroes, half of whom are children, who are totally unschooled in the racial etiquette of plantation life? Are they going to push this country to live up to the ideals of a biracial democracy for the first time? Or are they going to upend white supremacy? So they attacked our kids. It's foundational. And so I've been going through the archives, picking up dead children and trying to lay them to rest with respect and love and honor. Every time I find a child, I go out there on that acre. I plant a new bush, a tree, and I put their little nameplate down for them in the year that they were killed. But this isn't just a story that says, oh, Black children were lynched too. No, I actually start off with white folks. And I say, one of the most tragic aspects of our history is that we beat our kids to protect them from these people who have this long heritage, 2,000 years long heritage of destroying their own children and traumatizing them for hundreds of generations. It's locked in their bodies at the epigenetic level. And then you mix that with colonialism and racism. You know, lynchings were a white family affair. It was this kind of psychodrama where they could work out their family tensions, their class tensions, their pent-up religious stuff, their sexualized stuff by destroying Black bodies. At the end of this chamber of horrors, I want our people to emerge from this thinking, my God, our children have been through so much. And we should not lay another cruel finger on them. We need to have the audacity to lay our bodies down to protect them from any more pain whatsoever. And so that's what this Strung Up is about. And then how not just lynchings, but these other less violent, still degenerate forms of racism through pediatrics, racialized pedophilic pornography, the child psychology movement, all of that, you know, did the social work of lynching Black children in a different way.
Well, Stacey, from your lips to God's ears, that we lay our bodies down to protect our children. And just like that, it's time for our weekly roundup of all the things Lady Just Ain't Gonna Do This Week. Number one, Indiana passes a near total abortion ban. Now, if you thought for 1 minute that this decision at the Supreme Court level was kind of bad, you might have missed that big part where essentially the Supreme Court, kicking the decision back to states, allowed for women to be under the thumb of zealots and be sentenced to death. That's what we're seeing in Indiana, where they passed a near total abortion ban this week. Under this bill, all abortion clinics would lose their licenses because the bill mandates that abortions can only be performed under unique circumstances and can only be done at hospitals or outpatient centers that are owned by hospitals. I mean, wasn't that actually the strategy? To take out abortion completely? It's not at all ironic that they targeted abortion clinics, which is how, you know, this really isn't even about abortion. It's about control and taking control away from people who can have babies to be able to decide when and under what circumstances it makes sense to bring one into the world. Now, look out for more of this. And if this makes you mad as fuck like it makes me, I want you to take it to the polls. You have enormous power over what happens in your state. But as you've heard me say before, your superpowers will only work when you activate them. So let's get to work. And here's what we want more of this week. It is completely possible, though perhaps not plausible, that Donald J. Trump could be headed to jail. Well, well, dear hearts, I know and you know that I've been asking the question of what in the entire fuck is taking so long to take Donald Trump and put him in his rightful place, which is jail, for a very long time. And a long time out. This week, the FBI showed up at the crib like, we finna take a look around. And we are gagging, honey, because suddenly all those extremists who were like, refund the police, are suddenly like, defund the police. And A, in history, you will always find a time when people who are on the wrong side end up on the right side by accident because really they don't have a side. And they're really not true to this, any of it. But B, if you take out their dumbass leader, who else is going to be the dumbass supreme? He's been taking L's for all these idiots, honey. In any case, the pressure is on. And while Lady is still super cynical that anything at all is actually going to come of this, it certainly makes for good political theater. A plus for effort, in my opinion. Other things Lady loves this week, Inflation Reduction Act passes, which is good news perhaps for November. Okay, so. Like you, when I heard Congress passed a bill on inflation, I was like, huh? Where did this come from? So let me take a few seconds and break it down. So basically, this bill is like a scaled down version of what folks were trying to pass last year. You know, that Build Back Better thing. There's a lot in here that seems like it's going to be good. For example, an extension of the expanded version of the Affordable Care Act for the next 3 years, a cap on insulin prices, millions of dollars for environmental justice block grants. I mean, literally, they used the words environmental justice that will be used for things like air monitoring in communities that are near toxic sites, and money for the implementation of plans to help protect frontline communities. There's also stuff in here that allows for the negotiation of cheaper prices for prescription drugs that people depend on to survive, tax credits and incentives for clean energy production, and a lot more. Now, the jury's out on whether or not this bill will actually do anything at all about inflation. I mean, there's a lot of language in there about deficit reduction and whatnot that is basically above my pay grade for this week, okay? Oh, and how could I forget? This bill would tax corporations that bring in over $1 billion a year at a rate of 15%. This is very significant, especially when you bring it into the language of, what has the Biden administration or Congress done for you lately? And believe me, honey, voters definitely need to know and hear all of that before November. Even Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema got on board. Sinema, of course, because she finna lose her job, but that's another conversation for another day. Now, Lady loves. It's definitely not everything, but think about it this way. If you're like constipated and your stomach hurts and all you can really think about is taking a shit, and then you get a little bit of movement, that's relief you can feel, and it matters. Oh, I love this job. Other things Lady loves this week. Turns out you can't just make shit up, at least according to this jury. Now, this week, a jury awarded parents of a child that was murdered in the Sandy Hook massacre a whopping $49 million from Alex Jones, who's like a notorious conspiracy theorist, who spread the lie on his massive-ass platform that Sandy Hook itself was an inside job. Basically, he called the shit a hoax. I don't know, child. It's like, I feel like we're in the end of days. But anyways, apparently, this clown was a part of the January 6th insurrection, too. And so when his lawyers mistakenly, in air quotes, sent a whole damn batch of his text messages to the plaintiff's lawyer, where this clown admits that he not only knew that Sandy Hook was real, but also where he's allegedly involved in some of the planning of the attempted coup on the United States government. So guess what else happened? The DOJ took an interest, and it looks like they finna be looking at those text messages too. I mean, long story short, he's in for a long ride. And the overall message here, God is good all the time. Other things Lady loves this week, the Department of Justice is on a roll. So speaking of the Department of Justice, it looks like they really did get some pep in their step, honey, because this week, the killers of Ahmaud Arbery were also convicted of federal hate crimes, which means that they got life sentences on top of the life sentences they got from Georgia. Now, the father and son duo received additional life sentences, making it two life sentences, and the neighbor that they were with received an additional 35 years. He might get out when he's 90. Tell the people who are listening right now how they can follow you on the socials and learn more about your work.
So I hang out primarily on Facebook. So you can just look me up, Stacey Patton. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Dr. Stacey Patton. I have an Instagram page, but I have never posted. And it is like people who follow me. So don't waste your time on Instagram. And then you can check out my website, www.sparethekids.com. It's got great stuff for parents who are looking, you know, to do something different, to raise resistance. And then you could, you know, just always email me, stacypatton@yahoo.com. I answer questions when I get some free time.
Mm, you're amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the show. That's it for Lady Don't Take No. But I'll be back here next Thursday with a new conversation and more news you can use. We appreciate you joining us. And please, let's keep the conversation going. Tell us what's on your mind. Tell us what you like. And tell us what you ain't gonna take no more of. On Twitter, we're at Lady Take. On Insta, we're at Lady Don't Take No Pod. On Facebook, we are at Lady Don't Take No Podcast by Alicia Garza. We post ways to do something about things you hear on this show all over our social media. So, if we got you amped up today, check out the socials to find out how you can take action. Please subscribe and write us a review and let the people know what you've heard here today. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our incredible theme is by Latyrix. And this pod is supported by the Black Futures Lab. And me, I'm your host, Alicia Garza. Remember, when it comes to what happens when you do wrong in the world, chickens do come home to roost. Donald Trump, Alex Jones, and the killers of Ahmaud Arbery are examples of what happens when movements go wrong, but also when movements go right. That's right, I said it. Because Lady Don't Take No.
Lady don't take no shit. Insist on respect the sister. Walk around like a womanish. She won't speak less of something worse. Singing don't play. The girl take herself so seriously. People stare curiously. She got a natural way. Her hips sway furiously. Yeah, luxuriously.
Love y'all.